the Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab number 379 for Monday, February 6th, 2012.
Good greetings, folks, and welcome to the Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab, the show where you send in your questions. You send in your tips. We bring some tips of our own to the table. We try to answer your questions. And together, we all try to learn a little something new each time. Here in Durham, New Hampshire, I'm Dave Hamilton.
Here in my room, in my office. I call it my office. In Fairfield, Connecticut, John F. Braun.
That's the difference between when we were boys and now that we're adults. We went from having rooms to having offices. Isn't that?
Yeah, right? I corrected myself.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it's basically where all my computer junk and piles of garbage are.
Like I said,
piles of papers.
We keep our toys in our rooms and we keep our computers in our offices. It's the same thing.
All right. Hey, did you watch bowling? Super Bowl, right?
That's right. Yeah. It was excellent bowling.
Yeah. Nice game.
Yeah. Except the Pats choked at the end. Ruined it for us here.
Really?
Yeah, they were four balls in a row. They could have caught it about the 4 or 5 minute left mark, and that would have done it.
That's wish they made that Hail Mary at the end. Oh, that would have been beautiful. It could have happened, but it didn't.
Yeah, it could have. That's the beauty of a game like that is, you know, you really don't know right up until the very end what's going to happen. So, you made some changes in your life though. Some changes that many people because Mobile Me's going away, you made some changes. Why don't you tell us about them before I stumble even more here, John?
So, yeah, it's people who are using iWeb and Mobile Me Publishing will be very sad in a few months because Apple's going to cut you off.
So then
I've been using iWeb, and it's a fine program, but it looks like Apple's going to retire it, and they're not going to, you know, it'll still work, and you can still publish your things, not to Mobile Me, but you can still publish your content and host it somewhere. I think we talked a little bit about
right.
this. But I decided to finally just migrate my stuff off of iWeb over the weekend. And here's what I did. You know, the option that made the most sense to me was it's a service that I've already been using, but I kind of consolidated it and converged all of my stuff there. So what I finally decided to do was to put all my... Now, this is the only thing that I really publish is photos. So for me, this is the right solution. If you're using iWeb for something else, then this may not be the solution.
Okay.
But if you're doing mostly photos, then I think Flickr is the way to go.
That's what you've chosen anyway.
This is what I chose. And the reason I chose it was as follows. So one is that the programs that I use to manage my photos or share them all have a Flickr component. And there's basically two programs that I use. So one is, of course, Aperture.
Right.
And the other is Instagram. So Aperture when I use my, you know, more sophisticated camera, and Instagram when I'm on the road and using the iPhone camera. It allows you to publish your photos to a number of places, including Flickr and also to Twitter and Facebook and a few other things.
I was going to save this until the end here, but I'm actually going to take a little detour because you bothered to explain what Instagram is. I have a question about Instagram because I see a lot of people use it. Mm-hmm. Obviously, you're one of them. It seems to me that Instagram is built to mess with my photos. It's not really just built to publish them, though. Of course, it does that. But it seems like its prime purpose is to do some sort of filtering or make my photos look old or do something to them before it uploads them. It's not just a nice little service that publishes photos like TwitPic or something like that. Yeah,
I personally do not use it that way.
Oh, really? Okay.
No, none of the photos that and some people you see, they even post when they post their photo, they'll say no filter.
Okay.
None of the photographs that I take are modified with Instagram. On occasion, sure. What I will do, there's a very nice free utility on the iDevices called Photoshop Express. It's free. And if anything, I may crop a photo or I may bump up the saturation.
Yep.
And maybe the exposure. It has some very basic ways to modify the photos. But no, I personally don't like the Instagram filters because a lot of them just
makes it look dumb. I don't know.
I don't know about dumb, but to me, the challenge with Instagram is to gauge your skill in taking photos with a iPhone camera. Now, another thing you could do, of course, and some people do this as well, and I don't know if I'd say it's cheating, but to me, the spirit of Instagram is what can you do with the iPhone camera? And that's the spirit within which I use it. So
that makes sense. Okay.
Yeah. Now, the nice thing, as I mentioned, so it can publish things to a Twitter feed, which is cool, and it puts certain tags on it. The other thing is that Aperture has a built-in module where you can share with Flickr. So you take however you group your photos, whether it be a project or a folder or whatever, and you highlight it, and you get a number of options to push them to your Flickr account. There's a one-time setup where you enter your credentials, and then from that point on, anything that you select out of your projects, you can push to Flickr. And that's how I did it. So it's, and there's a correspondence between, so Flickr has a number of ways to define your photos. I define them in things called sets. And there are a few other things you can do.
Sure.
So it's pretty much a one for one. It was pretty much the same experience. So rather than going to iWeb page, you know, which I give people the URL for, you go to the Flickr page. But there are a number of things about Flickr that I think are nice. Now, there was only one stumble that I had is that, you know, I use the iFi and I like the ability to geotag the photos. Initially, I was having a problem because when the photos would show up, it wouldn't show the geotags. And I would like people to, or I just think it's kind of neat to see where the photos were taken if people are interested.
As long as it's not a security risk, sure.
Right. And so what I actually found out, so I was looking at Aperture and I'm like, why isn't this data not showing up when I publish the photos? And I looked in the photos with preview and I would see the longitude and latitude were in there. And I'm like, what is Aperture screwing it up? And at one point, actually, iFi had a problem with their software where they weren't filling in that data properly, but then they issued an update.
Okay.
As it turns out, there's a setting on Flickr that you have to change to say yes. So by default, they do not allow the publishing of the data, even if it's in the photo. So once I figured that out, you know, everything was great. But the other part of Flickr that I really like is that similar to Instagram is that it has a sense of community. So Instagram is neat because you can, like Twitter, you can follow people. And if you like their photos, you can vote on them. And if people vote on your photos, you get little notifications and everybody, you know, gets a warm fuzzy from that.
Yeah. Gold stars are good. Everybody likes that.
Yeah. Everybody's a winner.
That's right. Everybody gets a trophy.
Right. but also, so they have two things in Flickr, and I upgraded to Flickr Pro because there's some limitations. I think it's like $25 a year or something. There's some limitations in that only a certain number of your sets will show up, or I think there are upload limits. So I decided to drop the $25 for a Flickr Pro.
Oh, smart.
Oh, I know who that is.
No, actually, okay. You know what's funny? So everybody say hi to Pilot Pete.
Hi, guys. Hi, everyone. Ladies too.
The funny thing is Pete snuck in without really making any noise whatsoever. And then I flipped the edge of my iPad up just then and it bounced against the keyboard and it made all kinds of noise that had absolutely nothing to do with Pete being here. So there you go.
Nice. Anyway.
All right. But so the other things that I like about Flickr, and then we'll move on. But the other things that I like about it that go beyond iWeb. So one is similar to Instagram. You can follow other people. You can list people who are contacts and it can go through your a number of your directories, you know, who you know on Facebook and all that. And then you can add people. And if you add them as a contact, then you can see, I'm not sure what criteria they use, but you can see their photos in a separate stream and then they can see yours as well. So that's nice. And then the other concept that they have is groups. So some of these photo walks, and there's a few of them. So there are two groups where I never got around to it. Now I did, where you can publish photos that you upload and put them in a collective. So people that you've, hang out with on these photo walks can do it. And then there's also one, our good friend, Victor Cajau.
From the typical Mac user, podcast.
And but also a typical Shutterbug group,
right?
Because he also does a typical Shutterbug podcast. So he has a group for that. And anybody that's part of that group can publish their photos and that other people can vote on them and all that. So I like number one, it integrates fine with no extra plugins. So there are third party plugins, but the built in functionality is good enough for me. So you can sync your Aperture content to Flickr. You can see contacts. So a sense of community, and there are groups and also the geotag support. And also it lets you view the EXIF data in the photos, which may be of interest to some people. Cool. So I'm so far I'm very pleased, and yeah, so I'm done with MobileMe, and I'm probably done with iWeb. I don't think that I really have any reason to use it anymore.
But yeah, it doesn't sound like you do. I mean, if you're doing all that right from iPhoto or Aperture, you're good to go.
Yeah. So I didn't wait until the last minute, which I said I would do, to migrate my stuff. So I'm curious what other people are doing for their, because I think it's June, right? June is when a lot of this is going to get shut down. So I'm wondering what other people are doing, and you better start thinking about it. June's coming up.
I came in on the tail end of this, but I've been a Flickr Pro user for, I think, about 3 years now. And one of the things, I don't know if you mentioned this or not, John, is it's essentially unlimited storage. Of all your photos and at full quality. So it's a good way to back them up, so to speak, that if you crash your hard drive or whatever, you lose all your photos forever.
Okay. I noticed that they do limit, I think they limit the size of videos, but other than that, and the other thing that's kind of interesting is you can also tag your photos. So here's another thing where it goes beyond iWeb, is that you can tag your photos with a Creative Commons license. Where you can indicate to people, okay, here are the conditions under which I will allow you to use my photograph. And I think I mark mine as non-commercial with attribution. There's a bunch of options. I think another thing is that they also will give you an option to publish your photos to Getty, so apparently you could, if you want to market your photography and you're willing to share it, apparently they offer an avenue for that. And finally, I noticed that the built-in Aperture functionality also gives you an option of what quality you would like to upload. So you can say web quality, I think optimized or full quality. So you can, so if you are into thinking about selling your photographs, you may not want to upload the full quality one. And just for the sake of size and performance, I think I said, web resolution, which, when you see it on a web page is fine as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, as long as you don't want to print them. All right, cool. All right, so let's dive in here and let's go to Nicole. And Nicole writes, over a year ago, I sent in a question about my MacBook Pro trackpad that was freezing up and or not responding and just generally a pain to live with. It had been replaced once or twice by Apple, and I believe the motherboard was also replaced by Apple. You guys made some recommendations that I can no longer remember, but the long and short of it was that nothing worked. Then one day, out of the blue, the trackpad started working normally for the most part. The freezing ceased, but I would still have these random movements of my pointer when I wasn't anywhere near the trackpad. Today, something happened that may explain that, and I wonder if you or your listeners may have run into it before. I was working on the MacBook Pro in my kitchen on the first floor when I noticed a quick message flash on the screen that the mouse connection had been lost. I don't use a mouse on my computer. However, in my office on the second floor, I have an iMac that uses a Magic Mouse. Sometimes my husband will be on the iMac upstairs when I'm on the MacBook Pro downstairs. Who knew the range on that mouse was that good? While I sit here typing now, I see that mouse repeatedly losing and reestablishing the connection, which means at times it's connected to my machine and could have been responsible for controlling the pointer. Do you know if you have competing inputs, whether the native trackpad or the Bluetooth mouse would take priority? I think it's time to start turning off the mouse upstairs when not in use, or turning off the Bluetooth on the MacBook Pro, but both could prove difficult if both of us are working and need those services. Okay, so let's answer a couple of questions here, Nicole. Number one, yes, it is possible that an external Bluetooth mouse could cause these problems. In Snow Leopard, you can check this. You can actually tell the system when an external device is connected, whether or not you want the internal trackpad. Now, of course, this only applies to laptops that have internal trackpads. You can decide whether or not you want the internal trackpad to still function. And the reason they do this is because a lot of people find that they're grazing across the trackpad or what have you. And so if you use an external mouse, you might want to completely disable the internal one. And it's possible in all versions of the OS. In Snow Leopard, it is in System Preferences, Universal Access, Mouse and Trackpad. And there's a checkbox that says, ignore built-in trackpad when, and there's actually two of those, and one of them says when mouse or wireless trackpad is present. So that is one, that's how you do it in Snow Leopard. John, in Lion, I believe you said it's one level deeper, is that right?
Yes. So you have universal access, mouse and trackpad, and then you will see a button there, trackpad options, dot, dot, dot.
Okay.
And the option that you mentioned is buried there.
Okay. So. But you know, the thing is, if in fact that was causing it, it seems strange to me that it, that this would be happening, but we've heard of stranger things, so it's not that strange. But what you would do is, it sounds like you would never want to use this mouse with that particular computer. And so the way you would deal with this is you just go into system preferences and Bluetooth and find that device, because if it's controlling your computer or even has the ability to control your computer, it's going to need to be paired with it. And what you need to do is just find that device in the Bluetooth system preference pane and remove it. And that will unpair it from your computer, and then you're good to go. Your computer should no longer respond, regardless of how close that mouse is, whether or not Bluetooth is on. Your computer is fully capable of ignoring Bluetooth devices that you have not specifically told it to pay attention to. Would you agree with that there, John?
Sure.
Sure.
I rarely use the Magic Mouse.
Oh, you don't use any Bluetooth devices? I thought your pointing device was Bluetooth, but no.
Nope. No, you're what do I have that's Bluetooth? Yeah. I got a mouse, and I think I have, which I don't use too often, but I have a Motorola Bluetooth earpiece, but I rarely use that. I usually plug a wired headset in.
Got it. Okay. All right. Let's move on to Brian. Brian writes, I have a MacBook purchased in October 2007 with a 2.16 gigahertz Intel Core 2 Duo processor, 1 gigabyte of RAM, and running Lion. My computer has increasingly been running slower and slower over the past couple years, and I'm sure it could use a RAM upgrade. Do you know how much RAM I could put on this machine and how many sticks I should buy? For example, if it has 2 slots and can max out at 4 gigs of RAM, should I buy 2 2-gig sticks or buy 1 4-gig stick and leave the other slot empty? I'm also considering cost. I plan on purchasing a new Mac, either an Air, a MacBook Pro, or an iMac around the summer because I'm looking forward to using Lion and iCloud. I guess he's actually on Snow Leopard, even though he said Lion earlier. And he says, I'm looking forward to using Lion and iCloud, and I don't believe the laptop I have now would handle either very well. When I eventually do get the new computer, I do plan on still keeping my current model around as a spare and perhaps as the portable if I end up buying an iMac. Would it be worth it to upgrade my current computer in the meantime, and where could I find reliable but affordable RAM? And he also goes on to say, I'm a novice at installing RAM and unsure of how to do it. Do you have a recommended link of a how-to video online? All right, John, why don't you take this one? And there's quite a few things in Brian's question to discuss, so I'm sure we'll pass it back.
Yeah, I hope I can keep track of all of this. So
I know.
So one place you could go to learn about the specs for your machine is support.apple.com/specs. But that's not where I went.
No.
So you can go there if you want. though that is a one-stop shop for specs on pretty much every Apple device ever. So what I use, though, Dave, is my favorite utility to keep track of what not only MacBooks, but pretty much any Apple device, its specifications. And this is something called Mac Tracker. And you can find this at MacTracker.ca, Canada, I guess.
Yep.
Amazingly, it's free. It's donationware. I've thrown the guy a few bucks because, quite honestly, it really helps me figure out things like this. So I took the machine in question and identified it. And as far as I can tell, what he has is a MacBook 13-inch mid-2007.
Yeah.
And according to MacTracker, if you listen to Apple, you can get 2 gigs of RAM. If you listen to MacTracker, and this is where it was almost but not quite right. Well, it was right in the sense that this particular Mac, if you load it up with more memory, at most you can see 3 gigabytes. And I'm like, well, that's kind of weird. You know, so what, you put a 2 and a 1 in there?
Yeah.
But then I actually went to our friends at Mac Sales and clarified the situation. Now, the first thing you want to do whenever you're looking to find out about RAM on your Mac is you probably want to get the model ID. And this is something that you can find if you go to About This Mac, More Info, or go into the System Profiler. if you click, if you start System Profiler and then click on Hardware, you will see an item here, Model Identifier. And this is pretty much what any of the memory vendors are going to want to know in order to help you get the right chips. So what the folks at Mac Sales actually say for this machine is what you can do is you can actually put in 4 gigabytes worth. And they have a little caveat, so that's why I directed them to Mac Sales. So there's a little caveat in that if you put in 2 2-gig chips, it will still only see 3 gigs of RAM, but what you're going to benefit from is what is called interleaving. So it's kind of weird. So there is a benefit. So I think you could put in a 2 and a 1.
That's what I had in, you know, in our original MacBook Pros that had the Core Duo and not the Core 2 Duo. We were in right. a similar situation. I just did a 2 and a 1. Yeah.
Right. So if you get a 2 and a 2, then you will get a slight better. And I don't think it costs you too much more to get a 2 and a 2 that's instead of a 2 and a 1.
That's probably true these days. Yeah.
Yeah, and actually the pricing I found for 2 2s, I think it was like under $70. So in my opinion, it's worth it. So get the 2 2s. You'll benefit from the interleaving, which gives you a wider memory bus. I think it gives you a 128-bit memory bus with interleaving. And then MacTracker also linked to an article, though, annoyingly, we've been having this problem with Apple Pages. This particular page here, I still can't bring it up here, but I
had that problem earlier today where in Safari, no matter what I did, I couldn't bring up Apple support pages, but they would come up fine in Firefox, which is really kind of ironic now that I think about it. But
disturbing.
Try that, because I had no success. The reload trick was not working for me earlier.
Let's see here. All right. Yeah. Safari complains about redirects and actually Firefox complains about that as well. Firefox has detected
reloading
the server.
Now that you're in Firefox, reload, because I was able to get it to come up, but never in Safari. Okay.
Nope. All right. No, it's not coming up anywhere.
Yeah.
But anyway, so I did find a YouTube video that instructs you how to replace the RAM on this. And it's a nice video. And I think it's common to all MacBooks, and that the MacBooks, unlike some of the other Macs, do not have a handy little door, or at least the machines that you and I have, Dave,
right,
have a little door that you screw off and then you put the RAM in there.
I have a MacBook Air. So.
Oh, okay. Well, the MacBook Air, what you get is what you get, right?
That's right.
As far as I know.
But yes, it's much easier to just buy it from Apple with the RAM you want.
Right. So this machine, from what I could see in the video, you pull the battery and then I think you got to remove 3 screws and there's a bracket that you pull out. And when you remove the bracket, you will then see where the 2 memory chips in this machine are.
Pretty easy. It's really not that bad. I mean, they do have a door. It's just right. It's underneath the battery.
And of course, there are picture guides on iFixit.com.
There you go.
Yeah, so at most you may need some needle nose in order to pull the chips out of there.
I wouldn't pull chips.
They come out. There's 2 little levers. You push on them and they snap.
They got levers. Right.
Yeah,
and I think the video showed that. Okay,
I would actually hold off. I just to offer this. I would not at all advise using needle nose on chips because you'll snap them. I tried it once years ago and on RAM chips. It's a dangerous thing because you can apply way too much torque to those things.
Baby.
Well, I mean, you're applying all that torque on a tiny little spot, whereas with your fingers,
what could go wrong?
Yeah.
Use a gentle hand. Don't destroy things like Dave.
Not what I do.
Right. And actually, now that I think about it, when Duffy and I, when we went in his in the iMac that he brought over recently, I believe that also had some sort of button or lever or something. Yeah. So yeah, you wouldn't have to resort to another tool. So at most you're going to need, I think the only thing in the video, the guy said, you're probably going to need a pretty small Phillips head.
That makes sense.
00.
So in my opinion,
which you can also get from iFixit.
Yes.
So.
Yeah. Oh yeah. So there are a number of vendors for the memory. From what I saw, again, Mac Sales has it. And I think Mac Sales also offers for most memory a small rebate. So if you send them your old chip, they'll give you a few bucks for that. Yeah. So it'll help lower the cost as well. And I've done that in the past. So in my opinion, it's worth it. To me, 1 gig under Snow Leopard or Lion is way too little. And I'm not surprised that he's seeing sluggish performance. I think that's too little for any Mac. I think three is, I'd prefer four at the very least, but I think you'll be able to get by with three if
yeah,
you're and careful about management.
I think if you're okay with Snow Leopard with three, I think you'd be okay with Lion with three. I would not hesitate to jump that machine to Lion. I'm pretty sure it supports it. It's a Core 2 Duo, so it's got 64-bit in theory. I would say that, you know, Lion and iCloud would probably work on that machine. But don't let that stop you from getting a new Mac, because that's always fun. You know, add it. Just add it to your deal there. Hey, John, I wanted to tell you about our first sponsor for this show.
Oh, great.
Which is a sponsor we've had for a long time, Smile, at smilesoftware.com. They just came out with PDF Pen for iPad. And man, this is yet another one of those things where it's really easy to talk about it as a sponsorship, because it's something that I'm already finding myself using. It is PDF Pen on the iPad. It's nearly full featured as the Mac version. And what's really cool is you can take stuff from the Mac version and you got to update to the latest, and it happens internally on the Mac version, and save it to iCloud. And then you can pull up that same document in PDF Pen right on your iPad without really having to think about how it got there. Obviously it got there with iCloud, but that's the beauty of iCloud, is they've got this whole syncing thing worked out. And just like you can on the Mac, you can add text, you can fix typos, you can make corrections. The only things you can't do are OCR and redaction. Those are the only things that aren't built into the PDF engine that they're using on the iPad. But, you know, you can correct text, which is really cool to be able to highlight some text on the iPad and then change it. If you've got some stuff, edits you need to make on the fly, of course, you can annotate and all of that stuff too. They are right now they're selling it for $9.99 in the App Store. So definitely go check it out. There's some great information on the web at smilesoftware.com/geek. That'll bring you right to PDF Pen for iPads page there at Smile. And I hope you go check it out. And if you do buy it, go and review the app. Just like we ask you to review the podcast, you know, in the iTunes store, go and review the app and tell them what you think about it and share your feedback. They do really appreciate that. And it is something, just like it is something that helped us as new podcasters. It helps them with their new app. And so they ask you to do that, and I ask you to do that too. PDF Pen for iPad, $9.99 in the App Store, and you can learn all about it at smilesoftware.com/geek. All right, let's go to Simon. This was an interesting thing. Simon and I had an email exchange, I think leading into Macworld Expo, and it was this big back and forth, but I will explain Simon's question initially. And then we'll talk about what the eventual solution that I think we've got for him is. He says, I have a question which, because of the nature of its complexity, is quite difficult to describe in a Google search. I have a large folder, 8 gigabytes worth, which contains a program that I have made full of PDFs and HTML documents, all of which are accessed through hyperlinks from one file to another. My goal was to get this 8 gigabyte folder onto my iPad 2. Now I've got 64 gigs on it, so I should have plenty of room. Synchronizing with Dropbox works fine, but of course Dropbox does not let me run any of the links from the file. So I open the main HTML file and none of the links work inside the Dropbox app. Plan two was to drop the folder into a suitable app in the iTunes main window for the iPad, but that didn't work either because you can't drop folders in there, only files. My final idea was to use GoodReader. I used the Dropbox server sync within GoodReader, and presto, the initial few files work and hyperlinks run great. But here's the issue. It has taken 3 days to synchronize just 450 megabytes of the folder, and GoodReader has basically ground to a halt. It won't open now unless I completely shut it down, and then when I open it, it will take about an hour to sync another 10 megabytes. Maybe GoodReader wasn't designed to handle large amounts of data? Can you think of any other program that will run hyperlinks from HTML documents and allow import into the iPad, preferably via a wired connection? Okay, so the answer is very close here, Simon. It is GoodReader. That is the app you want to use because it allows you to see these PDFs and HTML and hyperlinks, and it supports folders, and you can browse the folder structure. It's totally built to do what you want to do. And actually, you know, John, as an aside, when I travel, I actually use GoodReader to watch movies. because it's really easy to manage what I have in there. I can pull it down from Dropbox. I can pull it down from the web. I can copy things in, and we'll get to how I do that. But it's really a great, really full, full featured app that just is very, very flexible in what you can do with it. You just dump stuff in and it does what it's supposed to do with them. So I mentioned that I copy files into Goodreader. Well, I use an app that's not easy to find. It's called Goodreader USB, no spaces. The trick is to find it. You will not find it on the Mac App Store, and you don't even find it linked from Goodreader's homepage. It's weird. You have to go to Goodieware, Goodieware.com/USB, and then there's the links to it, and you can download it just fine. And this works really well. It lets you copy folders in. You're not doing it over the network, so there's no weirdness with the connection or the thing going to sleep or whatever. You just USB to your Mac. You copy the stuff over. Simon has tried this and it indeed worked perfectly for what he needed to do. So if you need to get a folder of stuff over to the iPad, Goodreader is the app to use, and Goodreader USB is the app to use on your Mac to get that stuff there. That's my story with this, with Simon. It was a very interesting little tale it was a tale of great success and joy, and there was much celebration.
Joy.
That's right. We love the joy. So you still don't have an iPad, right, John? You're not in the club yet, as we like to say.
Slow down, man. You're pushing me too hard, dude.
I know. We just got you on Flickr today.
See, I just dumped iWeb and Mobile Me. You can't put No iPad yet.
All right.
I don't know if I see a need. I got the iPhone.
I know. That's true. That was huge. I know.
And actually, I do have not one, not two, not three, but four cloud-based services on my iPhone. I wonder if any of these... Now, Dropbox was mentioned, and I think Dropbox you can use... and Dropbox is also smart in that I think you can do local LAN syncing.
Yeah, so but his problem with that was you couldn't do hyperlinks inside the Dropbox app. Right. Issue is, of course, on your Mac, you can use Dropbox to sync and then Safari can point at that folder.
I see.
On iOS, every file is, you know, sandboxed. And so, you know, you can't have Safari on iOS pointing to your Dropbox folder because that's just not how it works.
But I mean, the idea here is, wasn't the idea that there was a desire to click on a URL and
yeah, exactly. And that's what he was able to do inside of Goodreader.
I see.
The question was just how to get the data there. And Goodreader, to be fair, like he said, syncs with Dropbox, but not very easily for folders.
I'll have to try this because I mean, the others that I use are Box, Pogo Plug, and Sugar Sync, all of which have iDevice clients. Now I'm not sure how smart each one of those are as far as, you know, parsing a URL or allowing you to launch one. So yeah, I'll have to fiddle more. I haven't really done a lot of file syncing. I've just installed the apps and
sure. Yeah, it is handy.
We'll have to dig into that a bit more at some point. Again, I got four just because they all offered free space.
Sure.
It's like, why the heck not?
Yep. Okay. So Phil wrote in and late last week, Apple released Airport Utility 6, and much has been written about it. I think our own John Martellaro kind of summed it up very nicely when he said that Airport Utility 6 for Lion is for beginners. And the issue is that there are many, many features that previously were available in Airport Utility that are gone now in version 6. But the good news, as Phil points out, and of course, John Martellaro pointed this out in his article too, is... Well, Airport Utility 6 is handy and certainly represents what Apple likes to do, where you've got this unified interface that looks very similar when you move from iPad to iPhone to Mac OS now. There are features that are missing and there are things that it can't do. But the good news is you can download what's now called Airport Utility 5.6, and that will let you have access to all these old features, albeit in the old interface, which... some of you may even prefer, although I have to say the old interface of Airport Utility was really kind of quirky and getting in there to do things. It was second nature to those of us that had been doing it for years, but not very easy. You know, you'd have to highlight it and then you couldn't double click. You had to click setup and sometimes it went one way and sometimes it went the other and you had to know, and it was kind of a pain. But Phil says, keep a copy of Airport Utility 5.6 with you. He says, I noticed that Apple has removed a function from the Airport Express on the 6.0 utility. Says it looks like they have removed the ability to set allow Ethernet clients from 6.0. Phil says, I use this because at the hotel I stay at, the Wi-Fi signal is stronger at the window. I connect my Ethernet cable to my Airport Express and use it like I'm wired. So kind of in a backward setup, using the Wi-Fi connection to grab the internet and then sharing it over Ethernet. He says, I recommend keeping a 5.6 installed, but don't get caught. He says there are some things like the show passwords option in version 6 that he likes. So I think Phil's right. Apple has now forked the development here of this, and there are some things in 6 that are good and some things that that are missing. John, you're cracking yourself up over there. Tell us what's so funny.
They dum-dumbed it. I looked at it and I'm like, oh no, it looks like on the iDevice. Oh man. But yeah, some of the stuff that's missing that I found particularly useful, and this is mostly for wireless diagnostics, but for example, one thing which you kind of had to do the hokey pokey to get to, in that on the old utility, if you clicked, if you went to the summary screen, so airport summary, and then you clicked on wireless clients,
right,
it would show you all connected clients, including interesting things like their signal strength, their signal to noise ratio, and the negotiated wireless rate, and the type of radio, and the MAC address. And again, for diagnosing problems or seeing what the base station thinks is happening in the world, as far as I know, that's one of the big features that is just gone. It's not there anymore.
Right. Right.
And I think DHCP clients is another one. So there's one screen that is useful for propeller heads like you and I and the listeners.
Yeah.
But you don't see, I don't know why they did that. Or why couldn't they have put a switch in there saying, okay, you want dum-dum mode or you want, you know, Mac Geek App mode or something?
Well, but, you know, remember.
Well, I'm being a bit harsh, dum-dum. But it's like I look at it and I'm like, oh, no, it's pretty. So that means they must have removed something.
Yeah, but this is not new, right? We've seen Apple do this before. They've done it with, well, let's see, QuickTime, right? iMovie, Final Cut Pro. They hid the library folder from us, so Lion, in a general sense, gets this, right? And Safari, even, you know, we used to be able to manipulate cookies and see what cookies were left behind. Now you can't. That's been removed from the UI.
Right. You have to, I think you have to use another utility, right? Or I know there's a way to do it.
When I need to do cookie diagnosis, I go in and use Firefox because it's still right there. Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, this is definitely the way Apple is pushing things, and that's okay. It gives us a reason for being here. We still have to know all the tricks and we learn them together. So thank you, Phil, for the email. That's good stuff.
Mm-hmm.
All right. How are we doing on time here? Let's see. Let's do,
Jesse.
No, that's sort of a edge case thing. All right, fine. All right. Prove to me it's not an edge case thing. Here we go with Jesse. All right, here we go. Dave and John, this is Jesse. I've been having this frustrating issue with a few files on my Drobo FS that will not delete correctly. I'm almost positive it's a permissions issue because when I try to delete it, it tells me the operation can't be completed because an unexpected error occurred. I've been doing some cleaning of these old files and it will just not let me change the file name or delete it. I tried to go into Get Info Inspector to change the permissions to you to my user and allow read and write ability. You sure this isn't an edge case here? Allow read and write abilities. But then again, I run into the permissions issue. I read that there is a padlock button that I should be clicking to give me administrator access, but I don't have any such button in my Get Info Inspector. I've tried to remove these files using terminal, using the RM command from the terminal, but it says I have an invalid argument. Is there anything I can do to delete this stuff, or am I forced to leave it there forever? And the one thing I skipped was he says the error code he gets is -50, Mr. Braun.
Wow, this is a really itch. No, it's not. Because, no, this is going to, I'm going to explain to you. I'm going to convince you, Dave. Now, one, you could find out what -50 means.
The floor, my friend, is yours.
Yes, it is. All right. Well, first, you could find out what -50 means. We've mentioned this before. We'll mention it again in case you're new. You go in the terminal and you type Mac error space -50. And it tells you, I mean, it's very descriptive. Error in user parameter list. It's like, oh, come on. It's useless. All right. But here's the, no, but I solved this problem because I had this problem too. And I did, the thing is, Dave, I don't think this is just a Drobo problem.
Okay.
I think it's an AFP problem. So that's why I think this is of general, more general interest than just Drobo owners.
All right.
So to back up here, there are a lot of network drives allow you to mount them using different protocols. And the one that is native to Apple is called AFP, Apple File Protocol, I think it is.
That works for me.
Now, the error that he was getting, or at least I had this problem as well, and I was getting an error. And what came up eventually, I think it was in the Finder, it was in an error log, and it said, something's wrong with the volume CNIDDB. Using temporary CNIDDB failed too. Check server messages for details. Can't recover. Okay, CNIDDB is some sort of structure that stores directory information. So what I found was a Drobo support article that explained how you can recreate this file. Okay. Which they say is safe to do. And basically it involves you SSHing to the Drobo because the Drobo is actually a little Linux computer, which is kind of neat. And you SSH into it and then you remove this invisible file. I think it's the gist of this. And upgrading to 10.7.2 caused this. But then there was a line in the support article that made me think of a strategy that solved the problem because we got a note back saying what you suggested, John, worked. Oh, and I'm going to tell you what I suggested. So there's a line in here saying, oh, by the way, typically, we're mounting via SMB, and SMB is the other protocol that a lot of network drives and Mac OS understands, and that's server message block, which is basically just another way of accessing a drive, and usually Windows uses it. But what it said is typically we're mounting SMB via Finder or through a Windows host. The data appears intact and is accessible while using SMB, and I'm like, you know what? It may be crazy, but you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to connect to the Drobo. Because I had the same error message with some files. I'm going to connect to the Drobo using SMB. And I'm going to try to delete the files. And you know what?
It worked.
It worked.
That's awesome.
and he wrote back. And I think that worked for him too. So I think, I don't think the deleting this or recreating this directory structure, or the CNIDDB, he wrote back and said, yes. Connecting via SMB. So anyone who has any sort of problems with an AFP or Apple Share network drive, try to connect using SMB if the device supports it. And it makes me nervous, though, that works.
Well, yeah, it indicates that there's something wrong with AFP, either AFP on the Drobo or AFP in general that makes it not want to work this way.
Yeah, I mean, I haven't noticed any problems since, and no other files have evidenced this. So I'm not sure what caused it to happen. Again, they suggest, Drobo suggests that they changed something. You know, I think we talked about this. Apple changed something subtle with AFP in a Lion, which caused some trauma for some people. So,
All right. Let's go to Allison. Allison actually is Allison from the Nozilla cast. And she came up and asked a question at Macworld Expo during show 377 about why her iTunes would essentially crash on sync. And we thought, you know, a good troubleshooting step, as we discussed, was turning off the auto syncing to see if iTunes would still crash when she just plugged it in, because that, you know, there is some stuff that happens as soon as you plug it in. And so she did. She checked that little box that we discussed, and it crashed and burned again and forced a reboot. So she did what you suggested, John. She downloaded Xcode and launched Spin Control. And when she ran it, she saw that there were two things that were spinning out of control, two things that were hung. And that was iTunes Helper, which is no great surprise, and Photo Stream Agent. And she says, while this is fun and entertaining and certainly points to that pesky iTunes Helper app, what the heck do I do about it? I suppose I could kill it all over its stinky butt, but won't it just come back? I could have sworn it used to be an account's login items, but I don't see it listed there anymore. Maybe I don't have a choice about whether to let it launch or not anymore. Is an archive by app delete and a full delete reinstall in my future here? By now, it would have been less work than rebooting every day or two. And there is a point at which phishing is not as good as cutting bait and just moving on. But We like to keep fishing here because it's what we do. Otherwise, we just answer every question with format you drive. Thank you very much. But we don't do that. So iTunes Helper is stored inside the iTunes application bundle. And so what, you know, what my feeling would be was, well, let's get a new copy of iTunes on there, and or rather let's get a new copy of iTunes Helper on there, which I would do by deleting iTunes and then re-downloading it from apple.com. So that would be one thing to try, because that gets that iTunes Helper out of the way. The other thing is, Photo Stream Agent is actually part of iPhoto. Now, iPhoto also has a portion of it that monitors what's connected and will trigger a camera import when you connect a camera. And the iPhone and the iPad and even an iPod Touch now are all treated by the system like cameras because, well, that's one of the things that they are. So reinstalling iPhoto to get a new copy of Photo Stream Agent out there would be good. Now, why Photo Stream Agent would be causing this problem doesn't really make any sense. But in this case, it is easier just to put a new copy of it out there because it's something you can do in a pretty targeted way. So so those would be my two. Those would be my next two things to try. You have anything to add to Allison? I'm sure. In fact, I am certain we will hear back from Allison on this because that's just how Allison is. And we love her for that.
All right. All right. I'm going to set up a filter.
You don't think we'll hear back from Allison once you set up a filter?
Yeah, I'm going to filter all of the email that if you did want to send us email, Dave, I think you'd send it to feedback@macgeekab.com.
No. Allison, please send it to feedback@macgeekab.com.
As long as she doesn't send it to feedback@macgeekab.com, because then I'm going to filter it out.
That's right. Yes. Everything sent to feedback@macgeekab.com will be filtered out, except for you premium listeners, which can send to premium@macgeekab.com. Of course, you can also send email by way of a phone message. Or did I say that backwards? You can call us at 206-666-GEEK, which, John, is
4335.
That's right. And we will get that actually via email, which is kind of cool. You can also Skype us to MacGeekGab. And that, too, we will get via email in the form of a voice message. And we certainly like that. You can record voice messages on your iPhone and send them just straight via email or record them via your Mac. And that works fine, too. And you can find us on Twitter, MacGeekGab, John F. Braun, Pilot Pete, Dave Hamilton, of course, Mac Observer, all on Twitter and on Facebook. John, how do they find us on Facebook?
Facebook.com/MacGeekab.
There we go.
And it's growing daily.
That's right.
I have one final suggestion for Allison, though. I couldn't help to just mix things up and
put
the contact info in the middle there rather
That's
than
right.
at the end, because, you know.
That's right.
It's just boring if it's always the same. The one final thing, Dave, I don't know if it'll fix it, but it's worth looking at. We've explored this before. Now, you remember our old pal Sync Services, and I still think there are remnants of it buried.
Well, it's running all the time. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, here's the thing. There is a utility. I'm wondering if she has a corrupted Sync Services entry.
Could be.
And how would you find that, Dave? Well,
is Sync Services triggered when an iDevice is simply connected to your Mac? I mean, it's possible.
What I see, Dave, and that this is why I'm offering this as a suggestion, may want to try this. Sync Services, from what I can see, and there's a utility that lets you look at the Sync Services database. And fortunately, since Allison downloaded Xtool, she should have this, and it's called Syncrospector, SYNCROSPECTOR.
And it's Xcode, not Xtools, but I know that's what you meant. And Xcode is free.
And this utility lets you look at all of the various things that are registered, as far as I can tell. The purpose of this is to let you see all the various items registered with Sync Services. And this can be programs or applications. Well, when you run the utility, you will see there is a column that says type, and one type is application, but another is device. And I actually have, and I'm wondering if she has a device entry in there that's corrupt. So what you may want to do is highlight it and unregister it. And then when you plug the device in again, maybe it'll re-register it.
Yeah.
Of course, make a backup before you do this. But this, if you're going to fiddle with sync services, so first off, do not delete any folders or anything. As we've pointed out in the past, that is a sure, that's a recipe for disaster.
Right.
If you're going to touch sync services, use this program. And what you can do is highlight the device, and it should be listed. And actually, just to show you what cruft is still in there, Dave, I still have an entry here for John's Crazer K1M.
Yeah, dude, you need to do a clean install.
No!
Never!
But it still has my Crazer, which is a phone I no longer use, but there's still an entry.
Wait, do you still have your Crazer?
It's sitting around somewhere. It's okay. I think it's, well, I decommissioned it.
Of course.
I think you can, it doesn't work anymore.
All right. Yeah, you can.
I may send it off for recycling or something like that, but I got it kicking around. You know, the one thing I liked about it was a clamshell phone. It's still the thing that makes me nervous about the iPhone.
Have you broken your iPhone yet?
Not yet.
Okay.
No. I got a nice case for it.
Gorilla Glass. It's good stuff.
You know what? I don't think Apple has ever admitted that that's what they use, nor will Corning.
100%. They both have admitted that that's what they use.
Oh, that's weird, because I went to a show once and I asked the person. He's like, oh, I'm not allowed to say. Come on.
It's definitely. Gorilla Glass came back because Apple wanted to use it.
Oh.
Yeah.
And I think they're coming out with a new version with more gorillas in it.
That's right. Gorilla Glass 2 or something that they were talking about last month.
All right. Yeah. So if you see it, delete that entry. It may help. That's the only thing I can think of.
Cool. All right. I want to talk about our second sponsor for this show, which is Barebones Software at barebones.com and BB Edit, which you can get to at bbedit.com or at barebones.com. BB Edit is like the granddaddy end all be all of text editors on the Mac. Fantastic. It's been around for a long time, but that doesn't mean that these guys rest on their laurels. They keep adding stuff to it. They keep doing things with it. And especially with version 10, they keep dropping the price. It's now just $50. It used to be, $200. Even when they started advertising here, I think it was $200. But now it's just $50. You can buy it in the Mac App Store. You can buy it at bbedit or barebones.com. Very cool things in version 10. They've got Dropbox support, which is one thing I really like. You can put your BB Edit application support data into your Dropbox, and then BB Edit will use that so that you've got all your same stuff on multiple machines. It supports Lion's Resume in an awesome way. And this is actually a feature that BB Edit's had for a while, but now it does it natively with Lion, that when you relaunch the app, everything comes back open just the way you had it before. Very, very cool. When you open code, and when I say code, we could mean something really geeky like, Objective-C, but it can also be HTML or even JavaScript kind of in the middle there. When you open this up, it automatically figures out what type of code it is, i.e. what language it's in, and then it fills in and highlights everything. Now, it doesn't mess with your code. Your code is still exactly text and not messed with at all. But on the screen, it displays it with colors, and you can fold up functions and easily move things around. Very, very cool. BB Edit also allows you to search, replace, and even edit files that live within zip archives. So if you've got something inside a zip archive, you can dig in. You don't have to unzip it manually and then rezip it when you're done. You just edit it and it stays in there and rezips automatically when you're finished. And lastly, then this is something that they've had for a while, but I hate to overlook it. Command line tools. We've talked about it recently, even as part of the show. But once you have BB Edit installed, you can install the command line tools. Now, if you've downloaded it from their site, this will be an option presented to you when you first launch it. If you've downloaded it from the Mac App Store, you have to go and get the command line tools from the site, because Apple doesn't allow command line tools in the App Store. But they all still work the same once you get them, and they're free from the site. So, you're not paying any extra or anything if you do it that way. You go to the terminal, and if you find a file that you want to edit in the terminal, you say, you just type BBEdit and then the name of the file or the path to the file, and it opens it up in BBEdit and you can edit it there. And then when you say save, it saves it right back out to where it was in the terminal. So it's like a fully featured, mouse capable, menued editor right there for the terminal, because it's BBEdit. So you can check it all out. $50, $49.99 even, at barebones.com. And of course, you can download a free trial to convince yourself that this definitely is the right thing for you. All right. We've got a couple of tips and then some cool stuff found. Joe actually has a very interesting thing to share with us. And so Joe, take it away.
Hey guys, Joe here from Raleigh, North Carolina. I think I may have already called in on this show, but this is podcast 376, and you guys were addressing a question so far as scanning business cards. John went through and mentioned a couple of the resources that could do this that were dedicated, you know, for a Mac. At about a $200 price point. And it occurred to me that for pretty close to $200, you could get you an iPod Touch and use your little Prismo app and had all these other features and capabilities that you wouldn't have if you got the dedicated reader. Plus, it's portable. So, you know, it's with you wherever you are. And another comment along that is I actually use a little app on the iPhone called WorldCard, which I find to have been the best of these dedicated business card readers. It does all the same stuff that you were talking about. I think I've only ever had about one card out of 100 that I had to manually go in and type something that it misread it. It has an anti-shake mode so that, you know, it waits till you quit moving before it takes the shot, which assists in the OCR. And it has a neat little feature, I've seen this in some other apps, that allows you to organize the visual of the business card in a kind of like a Rolodex file organized by either name of the company or name of the person or whatever. So if you're visually oriented, you know, you can flip through that way, but it still puts it inside your address book too. So if you're syncing it with your Mac, then that, you know, you get everything there. And I just think buying a dedicated card reader for a business card is probably a really bad idea. So anyway, I just thought I'd throw that out. You cut me off here.
We will. Thanks, Joe. That's an interesting concept that, certainly if you already have the iPod Touch or iPhone or whatever, you're halfway there or more than halfway there. And that World Card is $7, $6.99 in the App Store, because I always like to look up prices for things that qualify, rather, as cool stuff found. All right, moving to Eddie. Eddie had a comment about 377 and then had a little question that I'm sure John and I are going to want to discuss.
Hey, guys, it's Eddie in Tacoma. Just got through listening to the Macworld Live podcast, and I had a couple of quick addendums to put answers that you gave to a couple of people. Hopefully they're still listening. I had the exact same problem with the shutdown that the one gentleman did, where it just goes to the white screen and it just refuses to go any further. And what I found my problem was, it was an external hard drive. It was a Phantom Green drive that apparently would go to sleep. And when you tried to shut down the computer, for some reason, it wouldn't wake up to be unmounted. I ended up taking the drive out of the enclosure and putting it in one of my Hackintoshes, and it works fine. I'm guessing it's the chipset in the actual enclosure. It may not be a specific problem to that manufacturer. It may, you know, that chipset may be used in multiple places, so it might be an external hard drive. The second one I had was about the gentleman who had the slow network. And if I remember correctly, I may not. Your network will default to the slowest device on the network and within the bandwidth you're using, you know, 2.4 or 5 gigahertz. So if you have a B piece of equipment on your network, and even though the another device on the network is N capable, the network will default to the B speeds. May or may not be the problem, but it's something to look at. Anyway, I thank you guys for all the hard work you do, and enjoy the podcast. And this is where you cut me off.
Thanks, Eddie. All right, let's work on this backwards here, John. So the network thing, this is a an easy thing to misunderstand. The network will not slow down to the lowest common denominator. However, and correct me if I'm wrong on this, John, but what it does is sometimes packets are delayed for the faster devices if a slower device is actively communicating on the same on the same wireless network. But it won't just with the presence of say an 802.11b device, it won't slow an N network all the way down to 11 megabits a second. That's not what's going to happen. Correct, John?
Correct. Okay. We've discussed it. As you're pointing out, yeah, if slower devices are on the network. The other thing I want to mention is that if you put the access point into compatibility mode,
then
you probably won't be getting the maximum bandwidth. And let me explain what I mean by that. So, for example, I have the time capsule 802.11n. And as we mentioned, but I'll mention it again here in the show, if you go to your airport menu and you hold down option, you will see a number of characteristics of the base that you're connected to. And like, for example, here's what I see for mine, and here are the two important parts. So one is physical mode, and that's the protocol it's using, and it says 802.11n. Well, that's all well and good. Now, in theory, 802.11n will max out at, I think, 300 megabits or 240 or something like that.
Okay. Wait. 802.11n?
N at 2.4 gigahertz.
It goes 100 and how come I don't have the speed in front of it? It's 100 plus.
She's talking frequency. Are you talking frequency or speed?
Are you talking speed, John?
Speed in megabits per second.
108 megabits per second is 802.11n, regardless of whether it's 2.4 gigahertz or 5.
Really?
Yeah.
I got something in front of me here that says 300.
Well, it can, and can go 300, right? If you've got it happening in wideband and all of that stuff, that's right.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right.
The frequency range doesn't dictate the frequency range all by itself does not limit or expand upon the speed. Right.
Right. The figure that I want to mention here, though. So I see physical mode 802.11n. Right. That isn't in and of itself is not enough to tell me what the negotiated transmit rate is. Well, the nice thing is that that's in this list of parameters for the base station. So, for example, the one that I'm connected to, it right now says transmit rate 130.
Okay. Yeah.
And I believe that changes. Right. So right now I'm right next to it. And I believe that number will change if you start getting far away and the signal starts getting kind of crummy. I think that number will go down, should go down. So it could give you a sense of what's happening with your connection if you see that number is lower than you expect.
Right. Right.
All right.
Cool. As an aside at CES, I think I have this picture on my iPhone, so I'm going to try and find it. Buffalo had they were showing an 802.11ac device. And
that's the next big thing, right?
It is
gigabit or something.
Well, they were showing it, and it was going 802 megabits per second wireless right there in the hall at CES. Now, this is still draft, and it won't be released, I believe, until the summer is what Buffalo said. So we might even see it faster than that. But yeah, I've got a picture right here of it going 802.4 megabits per second.
Wow.
So that was pretty cool to see that. That's good stuff. Yeah. All right. So working backwards with Eddie's shutdown problems, that thank you for sharing that tip. External drive certainly could cause that. In a question that we didn't dig into, but the kind of the takeaway is valuable here in talking about shutdown problems. Listener Bruce, in a bit of troubleshooting back and forth with us, realized that he was actually having shutdown problems because of Lion's resume feature. And if he turned off that box, the open Windows when you restart box, his computer shut down fine. Now, John, I think you're going to tell us how to make sure that is off by default, but if you are having trouble you know, and you want to clean out kind of those saved application states, they do live in a folder on your drive in home, library, saved application state. So you can find the stuff in there. But if you just want to turn that off so that every time you reboot, it's not trying to relaunch every app, John, tell them what they've won. Or rather, tell them how to do it.
There's no way to do it normally.
Oh, so you have to do it weirdly?
But I will tell you, yes, how to do it weirdly. So, okay. So I dug into this a little bit. So of course, as you know, if you hold down the power button, you do other things, but holding that power button, you're going to see this dialogue that says, are you sure you want to shut down your computer? And there's a checkbox which says reopen Windows when logging back in. And it's always checked. Now, of course, the one way to get around it, always. Now, one way to get around it, of course, is to hit the space bar, which unchecks the box. Unchecks the box. However, I found that there is no way to, no nice way or Apple approved way, but I did found a cool little utility by Victor and I can't pronounce it. So a link to it, but this guy found that there is a register or a terminal flag that you can set, but the problem is it doesn't persist. So he wrote a little Apple script, and it's something called clean shutdown that will tweak this value. And when you come to the shutdown, then the box will be unchecked. And it looks like this is free, and I see a little donate button. So if it's worth it to you to, you know, have this functionality where you don't have to get the restore thing and it potentially messes up your computer, then throw our friend Victor a few bucks here. You found it? Clean shutdown?
Well, no, I found somebody talking about the terminal command, but then like you said, it doesn't persist. So you've got to redo it every time around. Yeah.
I think it's TAL logout save state equals one. I think that was the one.
Yeah. Something like that. So yeah.
All right. And I'm curious how he found, well, number one, I'm curious how he determined that was the problem, because I was staring him in a totally different direction.
Yeah.
So I don't know if what I suggested to help him see what the computer was doing, which I think was verbose mode.
Oh, absolutely. Take credit for it, John. It's good.
No,
it's good.
But no, I suggested two things. So number one, do verbose mode, because if you shut down, if you start it up in verbose mode, which shows you all the nastiness in the terminal you normally don't see, when you shut down, you should also see that as well. And maybe he noticed that there was a problem there. Or the other thing is that there is a, I think it's shutdown stall in the /logs/library/library/logs/ diagnostic reports. There may be a report with a dot shutdown stall, I think it's called, at the end of it. And that may list what is causing the machine to not shut down.
There you go.
So I don't know if he used one or both of those to find out, or if he just kind of used
Spidey
instinct.
Sense. That's right.
Spidey sense or mojo or whatever you want to call it.
All right. So I have a couple of cool stuff found on our list today. And I have one of my own. In fact, we have several. We're not going to get to all of them. But Kaz actually has kind of a cool one, and it solves a problem you might not have known that you had, but that's kind of one of the nice things. Kaz writes, he said, he was looking, it was actually the result of a question. He was looking for a way to shoot. He was the one last week in the show where we were talking about using, he wanted to display photos on his iPad while shooting from his camera. And we talked a lot about that. He found an interesting kind of workaround. He said that you can use Lightroom 3 in dual screen mode, and then if you shoot tethered, meaning plugging your camera into your MacBook Pro, you can set up AirPlay to have the iPad or really any iOS device as your second screen. And so Lightroom 3 in dual screen mode, and then you use AirPlay to set up your iPad as your second screen. And as soon as you take a picture, boom, it'll show up right there on your iPad, which is pretty darn cool if you ask me. And so he said that he can use it because he can give his client the iPad so they can sit elsewhere in the room. He's taking pictures. They can see what the pictures look like, you know, in real time. And it's very cool. So there was a video about this, and we will put it out there in the show notes, because that's what we do. So thank you, Kaz. That was pretty cool. Dustin writes, and Dustin actually is the author of Control Plane, which is something we mentioned recently. And Dustin says Control Plane, of course, being the thing that took over for Marco Polo when Marco Polo stopped working with Lion. Dustin worked on it, took the source code and reworked it into Control Plane. He said he also just released another free program called Tedium at tediumapp.com that manages, get this, multiple time machine backup destinations. So, you know, we talk a lot about backups and we've talked a lot about how Time Machine is flaky, but it's also, you know, a single point of failure. Well, if you wanted to have multiple Time Machine backups happening, you can, and kind of uses some of the similar stuff that he's got going on with Control Plane, but it's very purpose built to allow you to have Time Machine backing up to two different places. And you can set, you know, you can set some parameters for when that happens and why it happens and all of that stuff. So, and it is free and open source. So thank you, Dustin, for not only telling us about it, but for doing what you do and bringing that kind of stuff to Mac users like us. We really do appreciate it, man. And then lastly, John, I have one of my own. On Friday, Vern Seward wrote over for TMO about some panoramic photo apps, and some people in the comments talked about yet another one. And this app is awesome. It's called Photosynth and it's free. And I'm going to tell you what it does. And then I'm going to tell you who made it, John. What you do with Photosynth is you open it up on your iPhone and then you kind of tap the screen to start the process of taking a panoramic picture. And then all you do is start moving your phone in the way you want to create your panoramic. Now you can go up and down and it's constantly tracking what your phone's camera is seeing and then adding that to this kind of all in one picture that it's going to assemble at the end. You're never clicking the button to say, take a picture now, take a picture now, take a picture. There's none of that. It's just this very smooth situation.
Huh. Sounds like it's almost taking a movie and converting it to a picture, though
no,
I don't know the details.
It's not. You can see it kind of when it decides,
all right,
now I'll add a picture. Now I'll add a picture. It does.
Because a lot of these, you got to be very precise in overlapping. And
right.
From what I've seen, a lot of these apps are very cumbersome to use because just it's kind of a hard problem, I think.
Yeah, because you're right. You're solving a math problem and then letting the software sort of stitch it all together. But no, this sort of does it automatically and you just kind of, you know, move around and you move around slowly. You kind of get a feel for how you got to do it. And then when you're done, you hit done and then it's stitches it together and it even has a mode where it'll auto crop it down so that you're not left with funny edges and all that. And it's free. Now, ready? Guess who makes it? Microsoft.
Ah!
Hey, when it works, it works. And you know, ratings in the App Store, they've got like 5 stars. It's awesome.
So wow, they're still making stuff for the Mac.
They're still in business.
I know. It blew me away. It's awesome.
Wow. They can't die overnight, Pete. Come on.
Yeah, yeah.
You know how many people are running Windows out there?
And, yeah. Yeah, boy, that's true.
Right.
Which is a good thing for us.
That's right. It is.
No, so they got better. I must admit.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. So that's cool stuff found. Anybody else have a cool stuff that they found this week that they want to? Wow.
Were you going on about something, Pete?
I was just wondering if you wanted that reset the SMC tip.
What is the SMC?
Tell us your tale of woe.
I'll do it quickly, the Reader's Digest version. But essentially, I repaired a computer for a friend. The backlight kept going dark, and I troubleshot, and I got down to the idea that this thing was the inverter board on this MacBook. So I spent about 3 hours replacing the inverter board. Booted it back up, and boy, the light went out about 30, 45 seconds later, and I went, okay, that's a lot of time wasted.
Yep, and so $50 on a new inverter board.
So I started looking at what else it could be, although I thought I'd been pretty thorough in my troubleshooting, and came across the idea that maybe I should reset the SMC, the system management controller, on the machine. I did that, and it works beautifully. So probably should have done that first because that's just a matter of a few keystrokes and turning the machine off and holding down the power. In this machine, holding down the power button with the battery removed and unplugged. So
that's
boy,
a good
did I feel
that's a
stupid.
Good lesson.
It
no,
is a good lesson.
It, well, you took one for the collective team here,
yeah.
Pete. That's what you did because it is a good reminder to all of us that there are a lot of things that appear to be hardware problems.
Yeah, low-level functions in there.
That can be solved with an SMC reset or a PRAM reset or sometimes both.
Yeah.
So, yeah, and I've seen it a lot. Of course, it's not always the answer. Sometimes you need a new motherboard, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
But certainly before you buy hardware, just try it. What's the harm?
Well, I think especially... You know, I'm trying, for crying out loud, Apple. I mean, what is going on here? I'm trying to bring up the support article, HT3964, on the SMC. And I'm getting the same stupid error from Safari. I don't know what Apple's doing over there. Come on, guys. Somebody trip on the plug for the web servers. I've been having this problem with their support articles.
Here's the funny thing. On this machine here in the studio, they're coming up just fine for me. 100% of the time.
HT3964?
Yes, sir.
Maybe you're just not using OpenDNS.
I got it right in front of me.
John.
Okay.
Maybe
it could be Opt Online.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. I'm sorry about yelling at you, Apple. But I think they hint at a lot of power related functions may be tied to the SMC and resetting thereof.
It's weird that the backlight would be controlled. I mean, of course, it's got to be controlled by something.
Sure.
So, yeah, it stands to reason. All right. That is it. We will be back on Thursday with Premium Show 380. From now until then, we'd like to thank Michael Johnston from the We Have Communicators podcast for converting this to AAC. We'd like to thank Cashfly for all the hosting and bandwidth. We'd like to thank everybody in the podcast marketplace, which is the A2 desktop speakers from Audio Engine, BB Edit from Barebone Software, PDF Pen for iPad from Smile, and Gazelle at gazelle.com. Thank you so much, and have a good one. Don't get caught.
Made up.